It's 1:30 on October 25th, 2016, and we're going to call the meeting to order. Roll call, please.
Jim DeMartini. Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Jeff Grover.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Mandeep Dillon.
Here.
Sam Sharp. Mike Lynch.
Here.
Darren Garrett.
Present.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Joan Clendenin. We have a quorum.
Can we get announcements? Any announcements?
One good announcement. We do have audio and video equipment being installed. So by next meeting, if we want to actually see our managers when they're talking to us, we should be able to do that.
Nice.
That's excellent. Public comment. I don't see any public here, so I will skip that part. And does anyone want to pull anything from the consent calendar? No? Okay, is there a motion to accept the consent calendar?
Motion.
Any second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, moving on. American Realty presentation.
One second while we access our new technology. We will attempt to Bluetooth into the speaker.
Wow. We're in the big time now.
Getting closer.
Please enter your conference number followed by the pound key. That is no valid conference number. Please try again. Please enter your conference number followed by the pound key. That is no valid conference number. Please try again. Please enter your conference number followed by the pound key.
Okay, 8A. We're going to move on to 8B so that she can locate a number for us. Executive Director Administrative.
Okay, so 8A is the legal legislative update, and that one is mine. So this one's just really quick. You guys will probably remember Assembly Bill 1853. This is the one that was being sponsored by Sackers, and they had asked your opinion on whether you wanted them to move forward with it. This would make it where they add a code section that could just be adopted by the Board of Retirement should the retirement system choose to go independent from the county. It went all the way through to the very end, and when it got to the governor's desk, he did veto this bill. We understand that the reason he vetoed it was for the same reason that you guys were not wanting to get involved in this, because you felt it would make it too easy for a retirement system to leave the county without having to interact with the county and make sure that that was a mutual decision. So that has been vetoed, and that's no longer a concern. So that was all we have for that.
Information Technology Solutions.
Yes. We are in the middle of contract negotiations. It's moving forward slowly. The contract's going back and forth. This type of a contract has multiple schedules on it. It's not just for the project itself, but it's for maintenance and service going into the future. So just as an update, we have not officially started work on that part of the project yet. We're still working on the contracts.
Okay, so 8C.
You said you're moving along. Do you have any dates, kind of getting dates?
We were hoping to get this thing kicked off before the beginning of November. But at this point, honestly, I think we're looking at the beginning of December for it to kick off. By the time we get through, we're going back and forth in the original contract was a bit slim in details. And so we've been in adding the details. And, of course, it has to get discussed and reviewed a second time. but the attorney and staff is working hard to make sure that Stan Sarah is well represented in this contract. I mean, if everything goes well, it's not a problem, but if something were not to go well, you need to have the right points in the contract so you have something to go back with. So we are moving forward with it. Nothing's changed as far as price or anything. It's just the details.
Thank you.
Try this again?
Yes.
Please enter your conference number followed by the pound key. There are currently 1 other participants in the conference.
Hi, Terry. Can you hear us?
Hello?
Okay, there you go.
Terry?
Oh, I think we can hear static now. Hello, can you hear us?
New equipment?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It worked earlier.
There's a noise there. There's some.
Somebody there, they can't hear us.
Yeah, they have their mute button on.
Or our mute button on.
It should be ours on.
Talk to
Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
Oh. Are you there?
This is Terry.
Okay,
wow,
terrific.
Yeah.
All right.
Good job.
Thank you.
But Jeff, I think you got the job.
You're on with the full board, Terry.
Do you have to push the button each time?
Terry?
We're still here.
Is there a button?
Terry, are you still there?
Hi, can you hear me?
We can hear you. Can you hear us? Terry, can you hear us?
Oh, now I can. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, you want us to go ahead?
Okay.
Please.
Good job again.
Okay. So, hi, this is Terry Noble, Director of Marketing and Client Services at American Realty Advisors. With me today, I have Kirk Helgeson, the Chief Investment Officer. I'm going to give you a brief update on the firm, and then I'm going to turn it over to Kirk to really update you on the fund itself. Please feel free to ask any questions as we go along. I understand we have about 20 minutes and then maybe 10 Q&A. Is that still accurate?
Yes.
Okay. We'll keep it short and sweet. So the firm update is really, I get the easy job because it's such a stable firm. We are still one of the largest privately owned real estate investment managers in the U.S. We have had no significant changes to personnel. We have no changes to our ownership structure. We continue to grow. We have now over $7.5 billion in assets under management, and we work with over 440 institutional investors similar to you, and now actually have 10 offices around the U.S. With an emphasis on having boots on the ground in the areas that we are investing. So that's really it for the update on the firm, unless you have any questions.
No, it doesn't look like it.
Okay, thanks. So I'll turn that over to Kirk to dive into the value fund itself.
Well, good. Good afternoon, and thanks for giving us the opportunity to talk about the value fund. Just to kind of set the table, the value fund is an investment vehicle that we operate to allow our investors to participate in higher risk real estate investment opportunities. The value fund is operated by myself and Doug Rush, and Doug and I have been operating the fund since its inception in 2009, and Doug has been with me working the value space at American for the last 12 years together. Value investing has been a strategy that we have done since the inception of the firm 27 years ago. What I want to do is look, I believe you guys all have the slide deck, so just turn to page 4 and we'll kind of move through this quickly, and I'll tell you when to turn pages just so you can follow along. value-add investing for us is really a best ideas approach. With the open-end fund structure that we do have, we have the ability to adapt the strategy over all investment cycles and really cater the strategies to those that we view as providing the best opportunities from a risk and total return perspective that exists at that point in the cycle. Earlier in the cycle, at about the time that we commenced the operation of the fund, we were capitalizing on distress and disruption in the market. And later in the cycle, we're going to move more towards a defensive approach with timing being critical in the investments that we're looking at for the fund. The underlying premise that we have for the strategy is that we're going to take broken, transitional, or unimproved assets and transform them into core assets. And we achieve this through a number of levers or themes that we can apply to these investments, ranging from development, redevelopment, lease up and re-tenanting, arbitraging, mismanaged or capital constrained ownership, using financial structures to our benefit, and also investing in markets early are those that we believe are poised for recovery and those that are emerging and are, you know, different from the past, but positioned to capitalize on demand going forward. As to cycle right now, our approach is a bit more defensive given where we sit in this economic cycle. With that, we're investing and focused more on short and long duration strategies. On the short end, we're targeting assets with business plans that we can implement immediately that capitalize on the current and continue favorable fundamentals that we see. And on the long end, we're pursuing what we view as more protective investment opportunities. And these are investments that provide current income over an extended time frame. But these are assets that we see that we can unlock future value through re-entitlement of that asset, adding density on the property, or through an adaptive reuse. What we're not doing is we're moving away from mid-cycle business plan executions and pulling back on development, particularly development with longer development cycles. Every development that we have done in the fund has been a shovel-ready investment, meaning that we have permits in hand, the debt in place, and an executed contract to build the building. And that has worked out really well for us since the beginning of the time. As to the fund and development, development is never going to be a large focus of the fund contractually. We're limited to 25% of development activity. But we're going to use development at times when we see it as the right approach to investing capital. What we're also doing at this point in time is we're investing into the capital stack in investments using structures such as preferred equity and mezzanine debt, which provides security to our investment through the subordination of another investor's capital. And you'll see that in some of the investments that we've originated more recently. And lastly, just on approach, there's a greater focus on income right now, and you'll see that in the investment. Jumping to slide 5, from a product type perspective, we're focused on the primary product types, office, retail, industrial, and multifamily. We invest in for rent multifamily, office, industrial, retail. And what we're not investing in is the higher risk, non-traditional asset classes such as hotels or for sale condominiums as an example. Investment activity will predominantly be an existing asset as opposed to new development. And we talked a little bit about the contractual limitations we have on new development. And as to approach to investment, we are far more opportunity driven with less of a focus on product type or geographically targeted models. But despite this, as you'll see later, we've created a nice diversified portfolio of assets with representation in all four product types and pretty good diversification across the country. On slide 6, so Stan Foss has made a $30 million commitment to the value fund To date, we've drawn just under 50% of that commitment. Performance-wise, we're pleased with the value fund's performance. For Stanislaus, we've generated a since inception return of 19.43% growth of fees, with the second quarter showing a 3.3% growth of fees and a trailing 1 year return of 18.2%. As to the fund itself, the since inception returns for our fund over 6+ years of operating history has generated a 16.8% gross of fees return. This level of return has exceeded the NFI Odyssey Index by 442 basis points. So performance-wise, the fund's doing well.
Can I ask you again to measure against the 30 million? What number do I use at this time is committed?
So the committed is the net contribution. Oh, 30 million is the committed.
Yeah, level. What portion of the 30 is committed? What number would you say is committed at this time?
10.3
has been called.
So 30 million is committed, and we've called net 10.291 through the second quarter, and then we drew down an additional 3 million in August. So your total funded commitment, 13.291.
Okay.
Net of the return of capital.
Okay.
That was made in the first quarter.
There's an additional then 15, 16, 17, then there's 16 something to go.
Correct.
Thank you.
No problem. Just before we leave performance, we'd like to highlight the income return that we've been able to generate in the value add fund. Since inception, 4.4%, and that's pretty consistent over the life of the fund, which is good for a value fund where we're really only 80% leased and we have some development deals. We see continued appreciation coming from our immature investment cycle assets, including our development transactions, and we believe this will continue to support strong appreciation for the value fund in the near term. Generally, we're forecasting going forward returns in the near term in the low to mid-teens is what we're projecting for the value fund at this point in time. Jumping to slide 7.
Sir, excuse me. Can I have a question on slide 6? This is Mandeep Dhillon. You've expressed your fees in like a percentage basis. Is there any reason why we don't never express a dollar amount of the fees? I mean, you've expressed the net income in a dollar amount as well as the net appreciation, but the fee is in a... I don't see a dollar amount for the fee.
We can provide that to you. That's no problem. It's embedded in one of these line items, and we can break that out for you. At the $30 million commitment level, the fee, the asset management fee, I believe is 1.2% per annum. But we can break that out for you in absolute terms. That's no problem.
Thank you.
No problem. Jumping to slide 7. Again, we're in our seventh year of operation. In total, the net value of the fund is $344 million as of June of this year, with gross assets of $620 million. Leverage is moderate at 39%. As it relates to leverage for the value fund, this is all executed at the property level. We don't have any fund level debt other than a simple line of credit that we use for operational needs. And at 39%, we sit at the lower end of our target range, which is going to range between 40 and 50%. The maximum for the fund and where we sit right now is well below that is 65%. The debt maturity schedule is fairly well dispersed over the next 5 years, so there's no bullet. We've done a good job of managing it and aligning that schedule to match up with the business plan of the individual assets. Investor activity for the value fund has been strong. We have 49 limited partners. At this point, we have undrawn investor commitments of just over $300 million. During the first half of 2016, we've secured $136 million of new investor commitments. We've called $155 million of client capital to fund investments and have had no investor redemption to date. So between existing and investor commitments, were close to $350 million of equity potential for the fund. Is there a question?
Doesn't seem to be.
Okay.
We're good? Okay. Flipping to slide, on slide 8 and 9, the focus there again is just, as I noted earlier, it's an opportunity-driven fund, but there's what we've built here is a pretty good diversified portfolio of assets with representation across all four product types, and again, pretty good diversification in all the major regions of the country. And again, despite having that opportunity-driven focus, we've been able to build this diversified portfolio. On slide 10, I think the most important thing I want to highlight there is the chart in the bottom left-hand corner. With the fund in its seventh year of operation, there's a good mix of early to advanced business plan assets. For the most part, fully advanced assets are positioned for sale, amount to a quarter of the fund's activity, with the balance of the existing assets still providing upside potential to our investors. What we've developed is about 81% occupied, which occupancy is supporting that strong income yield that I touched on earlier. But what it also does is it gives the fund the upside through the lease up of this vacant space. And if the development deals continue to progress on time and on budget, additional appreciation is going to be captured. Slide 11 gives you a good overview of the assets. To date, the fund has originated 23 investments and we've had 5 realizations. On slide 12, talks about the first half of the year investment. So we've originated 6 new investments on behalf of the fund. Strategies within the investments are a mix of lease-ups, market recoveries, development, repositioning, and re-tenanting. And all are in support of the house view that I touched on earlier from both a timing perspective coupled with a defensive orientation. In the lower right-hand corner, you'll also note the origination of a B-note investment. We saw this was more opportunity-driven. As the bond market loosened up earlier this year, we saw the opportunity to invest in this asset. It's a pool of mortgages, and when we've invested in the top portion of that, pricing for that investment was at 1,075 basis points over LIBOR, which historically these investments have priced in the 850 to 950 range. So we saw it as an opportunity to get enhanced yield for the fund on an income perspective, but also act as a hedge to our floating rate borrowings on the liability side of the balance sheet. You'll also note 3 development deals that we've originated. And again, in all cases, there's no entitlement risk here. And in one case, the construction has already commenced. So timing, again, is key. And then also, in 2 of these development deals, we've originated them in a preferred equity position, subordinating the equity of the developer's investment to ours. From a speed perspective, each of these developments will deliver no later than 2017, and again, are all positioned to capitalize on the current favorable real estate fundamentals that we forecast to remain in place over the near term. Lastly, on the disposition side, as I noted earlier, we sold 5 investments within the fund. Each investment was sold at the completion of its business plan. 3 of the 5 assets were sold at 98% leased or higher, another at 93% leased, and the final was sold to an investment group. I touched on earlier about our approach in creating core investments. These assets were sold to AEW, a separate account, UBS's core fund, MetLife's general account, and Sun Life of Canada's general account. Returned strong, ranging from 15.5% to over 50% from those investments. We currently have additionally two assets on the market right now that are in the sale process, and the results of those sales is strong. In one case, we're under contract and have gone hard at pricing in excess of the mark-to-market as of last one, and the other one is in support of the valuation. So, you know, things in general are very good, and we're pleased with the direction of the fund.
All right. Are there any other questions from us? Doesn't look like it.
That's it.
Okay.
No, we're good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. That was the American Realty presentation and Executive Director Investment.
We have nothing for the Executive Director Investments.
Okay, then number 8C, discussion and action for proxy directive for State Association of County Retirement Systems.
As Donna said, this item is 8C. It's a discussion and action item. Staff recommendation is to direct Stan Sarah voting delegate to support or oppose the legislative proposals. This item will be presented by me. So as I put in your packet, there's two items that appear to be an action item at the business meeting for SACRS for fall conference. It's not real clear. They haven't given out the whole agenda as to what they will be expecting, you to motion, or if there actually will be a motion, as SACRS Legislation Committee is recommending to not move forward with both of these items. So we're contemplating that the motion would be either for us as Stan Sarah to support that. We would support their legislative not going and doing that on their platform, and or opposing, saying no, these items do affect all of us globally and we would want to try to change their mind and have them support them.
Our understanding is that these items were part of is it 1853? That's the number.
One is 1853. It's AB 1853 that the governor did not sign. Embedded in that was something that we had told you about at the last SACRS meeting that had the legislative proposal to change the voting rights of the retiree member. The alternate retiree voting member, as one of the counties is asking for legislation to change. So should they change it the way that they're asking it to be changed, it could ultimately change how we do business, because it would change or modify the 37 Act. So and they're asking for it to be modified so that in our case, our alternate votes only when our retiree alternate is not available. The way they're proposing is that the other elected positions, such as 2, 7.
It only applies if you have an alternate seat to vote.
Not true. Not how Merced is asking for it to be. They currently have a vacancy in their safety as well. They believe it was, that's why I say it's kind of iffy, because they believe that their as current data as it's being presented, it's not well written, and they're going to be defining it better as to what their wishes are. Well, so you may see something different presented at SACRS, but yes, you're correct. As it's written now, it's not real clear that their intent is that even if
no,
they...
I talked to Art about this article. They were not... If you didn't have... They didn't know that there were boards that didn't have an alternate safety number.
We did talk to the director yesterday, and they do currently have a vacancy in both of their safety seats.
Okay.
But
in their set.
Correct.
Yeah.
But like I said, it's hard to tell exactly what the vote may or may not be because they're still changing their documents up until their meeting. But what they presented to us so far, the intent would be that it would broaden the ability for the alternate retiree to vote in the instances where only three of the other seats
are not. So the SACRS Ledge Committee is recommending to not move forward on either item.
Exactly. They recommended that the committee decline the recommendation for the proposal of the sponsorship for Merced's alternate retiree voting. And because 1853 was vetoed by the governor, they have will be recommending that Ventura to pursue this classification legislation as a single system effort.
So we would need to make a motion granting authority to our voting delegate and our alternate voting delegate at SACRS to vote
either
as recommended by the SACRS Ledge Committee, or to vote in the alternative or in the opposite,
correct,
or whatever legal language you want to come up with.
Correct.
So I would make the motion that states that we grant authority to our voting delegate to SACRS and our alternate voting delegate to vote in line with the SACRS Ledge Committee, and that is to not move forward on either proposal.
Is there any discussion? No?
I'll second the motion.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Thank you.
Just as a comment, I will duly vote the way recommended.
Thank you, sir.
And that brings us to Ferris.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
So we have a few agenda items here to conquer. First, wanted to take a quick look at the September flash report, couple page document.
Yes, item 9A, information only.
And just a couple quick updates here, some highlights. You see some nice recovery from Jackson Square, both the 1 month and the fiscal year to date. So we added in the fiscal year to date column to the monthly performance reporting. Helps us keep track on that. And you see top line, total fund having a 4.4%, this is net of fees, return on a fiscal year-to-date basis is quite nice, quite welcome against our actuarial assumed rate. And we're seeing strong performance from both U.S. equity and international. A couple underperformers with our small cap exposures with Legato and Capital Prospects. And as I mentioned, Jackson Square having a nice improvement there, as well as dodging Cox. So those were two strategies that we had been looking at in terms of some real underperformance, and they still are under on a year-to-date basis, but improving. The other point I wanted to mention is in the international equity space, we have Fidelity. We were informed a couple weeks ago about some personnel changes there. So they, back in 2006, two gentlemen joined the team along with the lead PM at that time, who was Mike Strong. And so it was really a team of three, and Mike Strong then retired in 2013, so they had co-PMs, co-portfolio managers on this strategy. Now they've informed us that one of those co-PMs, Chris Stewart, is going to be departing at the end of the year, so it will be solely run by Brian Hensley. So, fine. We like that they're doing a succession plan here that's long and methodical and well-telegraphed and no surprises. We've spoken to them about the decision-making capacity of Chris and his role on the strategy and how that will change going forward. And Chris's role is primarily around the asset allocation of the strategy vis-a-vis the benchmark. And we notice that the benchmark and the strategy are actually pretty close in terms of the regional exposures. So we didn't see it as a big disruption. And Brian is going to be maintaining the same thought process and logic that Fidelity has always had in running this strategy, just doing it solo. So it's an organizational change and something we want to pay attention to, but we don't see it as a red flag kind of issue requiring immediate, you know, search or anything else. So something we want to watch and watch closely, but probably actually a good step. Having co-PMs can often be its own problem, so having single leadership may actually be a better solution here. Anyhow, and you can see the performance. It's under on the one-month and fiscal year-to-date and year-to-date basis, but it has been as well for some time. So we'll continue to watch that.
Thank you.
Can you remind me again what we're doing on the direct lending? It doesn't appear for a couple months or something?
Direct lending is valued quarterly.
Quarterly?
Yes.
So we'll see one.
So we'll see the quarterly report at the November meeting.
November.
Yes.
Okay.
So if that's all well and good, I'd move on to item 9B. Also a discussion item. So this is the asset allocation implementation plan. And it's kind of a spreadsheet with pretty blue bars. The idea here is that we showed you an implementation plan at the July meeting, and it outlines some of the key milestones. And Trustee Grover, I believe you had raised the question, do we have any particular agendas that are going to be more full than necessary or that are really going to demand a lot of our time? So we took a look at it and mapped it out more methodically, thinking, okay, how much can we conquer at each meeting, being reasonable, being prudent, and respectful of your time? And so here is what we've come up with. And the idea is that just that, not too much in any one meeting, and you'll see that the total time allocated to investment topics is generally around an hour or less. And that includes the monthly flash reports and the quarterly investment reporting. Of course, all of this is subject to change, and it's also subject to questions and answers and how much discussion we have, but at least it gives us a roadmap for what we're going to do each meeting, make sure we don't have any, you know, big topics addressed at, like, the, you know, November meeting where we might have Thanksgiving kinds of issues or holiday issues. Keep those kind of shorter and on focus and be able to really work through this methodically. The other point I wanted to make is that you're going to see some interesting pieces here. Like in October, the last topic for today is the search on the liquidity mandate. So we have that targeted for today. I'm going to be doing that presentation. But then we have it coming back to you in December for the finalists. So that gives us a month or two to work through any feedback and issues we might have, do any due diligence, and come back to you in December. So we have it kind of staggered in that way. Same with November. We have the U.S. Treasury mandate. This one's a little bit different because this one is viewed as pretty straightforward. We think we can probably tee it up, get a decision made at that meeting without too much work in terms of follow-up. And we'll show you why in November, but that should be a pretty straightforward one. So we make that search and make those decisions. Go through the January meeting, present risk parity, bring back the finalists for risk parity in February, and then in March is the first rebalance. So through all of this work, we haven't actually proposed moving any money until we get to March. And that's where we would then simultaneously implement what we refer to in the implementation plan as phase one. We put in place the liquidity mandate, US Treasury mandate, and risk parity all at once. It syncs up with the implementation plan we showed you, keeps everything running on course, and that gives us enough time that if we see anything and we want to hit the pause button, we can do that. So I think that's kind of the approach here.
Are there any questions? Probably not.
That took the 5 minutes it was allocated. So. The next topic I want to move on to is 9C, which is a follow-up to our discussion on the investment policy statement. So I think appropriately, there were some questions and comments coming back from the IPS draft that you saw, saying, whoa, 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 hold on. Do we really understand everything that's going on here? So the two documents you have in front of you, one is called the Stansera IPS Development Topic Mapping. It's a three-page document. And what this does is it takes essentially the table of contents on the left-hand side for our current IPS and makes sure that every one of those topics is addressed somewhere in the new regime. If it's not in the new IPS itself, it's being handled in directives or in procedures.
For example, I was concerned when we took the restriction on the leverage out of the policy. Where would I find that now? What right. controls, how much leverage do you have?
So the leverage would then be moved either to an investment management agreement where it's specific to the investment strategy that we're using.
Can I use this to find out how it's going?
Yes.
Oh.
So it would be somewhere on the left-hand side. Now that one in particular, let's see.
On page 2, is it liquidity number 10?
In the past, we haven't allowed leverage, and now we are, because we feel we can control it.
Mm-hmm.
So the question I have is, okay, how much do we allow it? As we took out of the policy, do the managers right now have no restrictions? So if Dodge and Cox want to use leverage, they could?
No, the current policy is still in place. We did not adopt the new policy.
This,
we're working our way to it.
Good.
Now, the current policies, nothing's changed.
Okay.
So
we didn't send that out to our manager?
No,
good.
No, that was just, and I wanted you to see it so you could see where we were going with the restated policy. And during that conversation, because we didn't do a red line, because we're literally redoing the entire thing, Ed wanted to bring this to you and give you a better idea of what was in the original is listed under the current IPS table of contents.
Right.
And every single thing in the current policy will be addressed somewhere else. And
good.
You will be able to map it out and we can discuss it.
So, for instance, my subject will everything be somewhere in there.
Yes, but we're trying to think of where it's currently addressed.
It's under forbidden. I don't have that in front of me.
Prohibited investments?
Prohibited investments, yes.
Number 18.
So it looks like that's going to stay in the IPS. So there will be something in the IPS to include the prohibited investments.
We're going to change it.
We're going to change it, and
we're going to allow some leverage, but of course we're not going to allow infinite leverage.
Right.
Yeah, so some
so it will it get its own line item on here? Is that what?
I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How this and how we do it.
Actually, for this one, we would recommend pulling it from the investment policy statement and putting it in the investment directives. And we could have a specific investment directive written to leverage so that it would be very clear. And the idea there is that you don't have to read through the whole IPS to find out what's the leverage policy. You just simply turn to the leverage policy.
Well, and the policy might be different for different managers?
It can be.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. I'd like to keep an eye on that one question. Okay.
Okay. So that's a great example of exactly how we want to use this.
Yeah.
And then the other document we have is the governance document summary that takes the new IPS, outlines its table of contents, along with a proposed and initial schedule of procedures and schedule of directives. So we can take that directive and say, okay, we want to create a specific directive here, call it 9, to address liquidity,
okay.
or leverage. And the schedule of procedures is the part we were talking about last time in terms of we envision this as being staff-led because this is really the workings, how things happen. So it's something I'm kind of on the outside looking in, as are you, but we want to know that it's in place and that if there's any questions about how things work, there's a document, a manual we can turn to.
Mm-hmm.
And both of these will be very modular. So if we have a new procedure or a new directive, it gets written up, it gets inserted, and it's more of a stack of documents rather than a well-coordinated investment policy statement itself.
So, for instance, leverage could be number 9 if you want to.
Exactly. Okay. So let me just pause there and get some feedback from you. Does this make sense? Do you like the direction we're heading? Do you have any feedback on the IPS draft that you saw last time? And so we're happy to take back any feedback and work through that. I think last time we said Rick and staff could coordinate that. If anyone has any comments.
And when we come back to you with the document, we can provide this again, the math, so that you know where you're going with it. So you're not constantly looking through the old document, trying to find it in the new document. We'll do our best to give you a map so it makes it easy to find your place.
So when you're done, you'll have three different documents then? Or will it be you have two? Or you'll have three? So you'll have a policy document and then a procedure and then a directive.
That's right.
And so because each one has a different user, I would say. Is that why?
Yes, and clarity as okay. As the system grows and becomes more complex, having the policies broken out is an easier way to manage that complexity. Hmm. So it allows us to have an investment policy statement that's reflective of those board-level policy issues that you're making. And we expect that to be somewhat more foundational, more directional, more higher level. But there's also a lot of decisions that you're making in terms of like the asset allocation and the annual reviews we'll be doing to that, that we do expect to change annually. So the directives process allows us a more fluid structure to address those changes. And we tie together through reference. So,
okay. Yeah. And the procedures are internal use for the staff?
Correct. So our next steps on this would be to continue our work. We expect to bring back a finalized IPS in January along with finalized procedures. And the directives will be started and, as I said, ongoing. So we'll get the basic ones written and in place and then continue on from there. So our game plan.
Thank you.
It's important to note that no new contracts will be signed with any of the new managers until the board has adopted the new investment policy as well. So we're all kind of on a timeline to get this all done so we can keep this marching forward with the asset allocation.
Okay. Liquidity search.
Okay, this is actually a discussion and action item, so I'm going to have Kelly go ahead and read what the recommendation would be, and then Ed's going to take it and
okay. This item is 9D. This is a discussion and action item. The staff recommendation is that the board direct staff and Verus to conduct an on-site due diligence with selected investment managers, determine liquidity portfolio structure, and present a final recommendation to the board at the December meeting. That can be found on your slide 4. So that is the motion that we're looking for.
Take it away.
So be presented by Ed.
So this is exciting. Our first real step into the FFP structure. So we talked a lot about creating the fixed income portion, and this is it. This is the portion of the portfolio that is really the bedrock of it. We're talking about a short duration fixed income strategy managed by probably multiple managers so that we know that in fulfilling the goal of this plan to pay pensioner benefits, to pay those payments, we have those safe and secure. We know how they're being managed very conservatively. And when we did the asset allocation, we looked at this and we said, okay, through all the modeling and analysis and everything, we came up with 18% of plan assets would be allocated to this. It's $330 million. So it's pretty sizable. Probably don't, again, want to put all our eggs in one basket, so we're talking about a multi-manager solution. So we have a search book that I'd like to work through with you, a few pages, not page by page, but certainly want to highlight a couple of them. The first I'd like to jump to is page 6. And this is our manager's search process. I'll highlight a couple of things here in the process. because this really leverages some work we did earlier this summer in a very, very similar mandate. And what we did is we conducted an RFI to the investment community and basically opened it up to everyone who could possibly want to bid. We essentially put in no minimum requirements whatsoever. We said, if you think you're interested in this and you have something to offer, let us hear it. And so we conducted that RFI, and we got 52 responses.
Out of how many? 52 out of how many?
Well, out of 52. We got 52 responses. We opened up. Yeah, exactly.
There were no requirements for everybody threw mud at the wall.
Yeah.
So everyone said they want to do it.
Yeah. So if you think about some of the large fixed income shops that you know, like, you know, PIMCO or Western Asset or Dodge & Cox, .. 52 responded. That was a little bit surprising to us. There were some names that I hadn't seen before.
That's a lot of RFPs to read.
Well, RFIs. We kept them short. And then we went through and read them all and vetted them and came up with a select list of 12. And so that's the second process here on page 6, second step. 12 firms really had strong responses to that RFI, and they were selected to fill out an RFP. And then we conducted due diligence on those, meeting them in person and conference calls to get a real sense of who can do what, who's really good at this across all dimensions that you think about, who has the personnel, the experience, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And who made that cut to 12, you and Rick?
No, this was work we did prior. So what we did is we worked through this, the 52 down to 12, the 12 down to what we're presenting you today are the 6 that look like the strongest.
Okay, but is the we, you, and no one else?
Varys.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And the last point on page 6, the bottom there, is a short list of high-quality solutions and products managers. I'm going to get into that in a moment. Page 7 has the criteria. But page 8 and 9 get into the solutions versus products kind of dynamic. And this is interesting because when we talked about, when we talked to these managers about what can you do in helping us think through the cash flows and the liability matching and what we're really trying to do here, some of them said, oh, we have capabilities to do just that. We do it for LDI, liability-driven investing kind of mandates with corporate plans. We do it for other pension plans. We do it for other insurance companies, what have you. We have that ability. We have, you know, actuaries on staff and modeling capabilities and what have you. So it wasn't just we have a good short-term bond fund that we think you really like. It's we have that, but we also work hard on the cash flows and getting that part of it right.
Do they need information from us about our...
Yes. Okay. Yes, they do. And so that was kind of interesting. So we grouped that into a group called Solutions because they're offering more than just that product. Then there were others that were just products saying, we don't do that, that's not our thing. But we do have a really compelling bond fund that you might be interested in, let us tell you about it. And so we kind of grouped them into that manner. And there are pros and cons to each of them. But it was interesting to see that kind of evolution come out. So page 11, then we started thinking about, okay, so what could we do with these? We could combine them in a couple different ways. One, on the left-hand side, we could just pick one. We could just say, here's who we want. Two, we could take two managers and work them in parallel. So essentially, we could take two solutions managers or two product managers and have them just run side by side and see how they do against each other. And that's kind of an attractive solution because if either one of them have an organizational disruption kind of event, you can easily switch from one to the other. So you have built-in redundancy. And then the third was, what if we used multiple managers but just allowed them to play to their strengths? Like if one is really good about managing cash and short-term and can do this cash flow matching thing, let them do that. And if we want someone else to manage maybe a 2 to 3 year bond portfolio, slightly longer but not out of the realm of things, let them do that. Maybe we can just pair them side by side. So we had a couple different portfolio design opportunities here, which we're just showing in that respect. And in page 12, then gives a graphic for how they can come together. So this graphic here basically has an orange line at the top showing what our benefit payments would be over time and how that would be fulfilled. And manager B is one of these product managers, just give me a bond fund. And manager A is, we're a bond fund, but we're going to do the cash flow matching to exactly what your benefit payments would be. So that's how that kind of solution can come to be used. then pages, yes, sir.
These bars, the blue bars, does that mean we've got two different amounts invested with them?
Likely. Okay. We can also give bond managers instruction as to, do we want to just pull the yield off their portfolio, or do we want them to actually sell and we'll replenish them? So we can do a couple different things.
Okay.
Pages 14 and 15 then highlight three solutions managers on 14 and three products managers on 15. And so the three solutions managers on 14, Insight, Conning, and Wellington, all very strong firms, all experienced in this, and typically more conservative on their bond funds. And so Insight on the left-hand side is actually part of BNY Mellon. Insight is a firm based in London, but because BNY Mellon is headquartered in New York, we have it as New York. And the team that's running this that you see towards the bottom third, that team actually comes from Cutwater, who had been acquired by Insight. So we look at that and we said, okay, now we know your ownership structure, it seems like things are pretty stable now, and we like that, so they are a strong competitor here. They manage their bond portfolio really conservatively, and they said, you know, when you look at our strategy, don't look at whether we match the Barclays 1 to 3 year government or government credit benchmark. We don't care about that. What we're trying to do is match your liabilities. And so show us your liability stream, we'll create a bond portfolio to match that, and you'll be fine. And so it's kind of the right approach. In fact, as we're talking about these managers, we benchmark them for comparison purposes to the Barclays 1 to 3 year gov credit. When we actually implement it, we'll adopt our own customized benchmark and say, we want you to do this, and it's probably going to be very, very similar to their approach here. Conning is another strong competitor. They're based in Connecticut. This is really the work of two people, Awais Rana and Lynn Ryan. And so we met with them and got an understanding of their structure. They come out as the lowest cost solution, which is interesting. They're just a flat 11 basis points. They do the solution as well as the bond management side of things. And they have great numbers through it. So we'll take a look at those in a moment. They have gone through some ownership changes as they were a portfolio company of a private equity firm. The private equity firm sold them, as we know private equity firms do, and they're now owned by Cathay. So it's a Taiwan-based financial holdings company. Cathay has a track record of never selling anybody. So they look like they're going to be a long-term owner of Conning. So it gives us some comfort there. We weren't exactly crazy about the ownership changes that they've had, but it looks like those are in the past. And then Wellington, Wellington comes out a little bit on the higher side in terms of the fees, but they also offer a good product, and they do more than just the cash management. They are investing across treasuries, agencies, mortgage backs, and asset backs. So they start bringing in a little bit more of that product dynamic. On page 15, Prudential.
Yes, sir. In your key investment professionals, those parentheses numbers, that's how long they've been with, how long they've been in the industry and how long they've been with the firm?
That's right. That's right. On the products managers on page 15, Prudential, DFA, and PIMCO. So Prudential on the left-hand side also comes out relatively high on the fee side. And they are really good at managing credit bond portfolios. And it's probably not surprising because Prudential is an insurance company. That's how an insurance company manages or manages its general account. Lo and behold, they tend to be good at it. So while they are high on their fees, they also offer some really nice performance net of fees. So it appears that you get what you get more than what you pay for there. DFA takes a more systematic approach to it, which you're probably somewhat familiar with. DFA generally takes a very consistent approach to the markets. They look at the markets and say they're efficient. We're not going to outgame anyone by trying to do incremental research on any individual company. Let that to someone else. We're just going to look at how the markets are priced and find where the markets are telling us inefficiencies are. And so with a portfolio like this, they mainly look to the term and the term structure, and they look at where bonds are priced between the 0 to 3 year term structure and look for mispricings along that. Slightly similar with credit, they look for Where credit qualities gap out, that indicates prices are low and they'll buy those. And PIMCO on the right-hand side, I'm sure you're familiar with them, they take a very similar approach as what they do with the PIMCO total return that is in our portfolio. They're taking a very high-level, multi-sector approach, macro view of the investment space, looking at duration, looking at yield curve, looking at sectors, looking at all of the different components there. And so they also come out slightly higher on the fee side of things. So six really strong candidates. They can be paired in different ways. So this is an interesting search because whereas most of the time you're probably thinking about there are three horses in this race, which one do we want? In this case, there are six horses. How do we want to combine any one, two, or three of them to create what we want? So it's a little bit different. And that's why our recommendation is that continue working through this search today, but then give staff and Verus direction to go back, come up with a solution that works, and present that solution to you, which is, I think, a little bit different than what we've done in the past.
So rather than hearing from each of these, you recommend you three of
these are very similar. Us and staff work together. So part of this mandate that's also unique is that this whoever is hired is going to be working very closely with staff. So there's a real client servicing dynamic to this, as well as just the performance aspect.
Is that true with all six or just the bottom three?
It's true with all six.
So if we hire a solutions manager, would they only be identifying solutions that applied to the money that they had under management, or would they be taking into account this possible partner and the money that was invested there? Would they be giving direction to this other company on what they were going to need to be drawing?
Great question. There's a sharing of information, and the modeling that they do incorporates the information of that bond portfolio. So naturally, they're looking at it saying, we don't really want to know too much about what they do, but we do need to know some characteristics, and they need to share some information so that we model it appropriately. So there is a communication flow there, but they don't want to get into the business of knowing which bonds they're buying and selling and why. Leave that strategy to them.
Did you consider Dodge & Cox as part of one of the products managers?
Yes. So.
But they're not on this list.
They are not. They did not submit an RFP or an RFI. And, interestingly, because they are not strong in short-duration product. So they manage credit portfolios. And you think about it, all their presentations, we get to know the companies. We buy their stocks. We buy their bonds. Short-duration
is. We hold on to them forever.
They're not ready to sell.
Exactly. So short-term is a different skill set, and they're fine not playing in that space.
So the 52 to 12, Verus did. And then the 12 to 6, Verus did that too?
Yes.
With or without staff?
Without.
Okay. Why wouldn't staff be?
Staff would be involved in the next level. Verus, which is why we have a consultant, is to whittle it down to a reasonable number and do the deep dive. And then staff would work with Verus to do the next level of diligence.
What do you envision coming to the board? These are the three or two we recommend, or we're going to interview a couple people, or what?
Correct. Ed, go ahead.
Yeah, I would envision it being something much like that. It would be something like, we like these two managers for these reasons. We've talked to them about how they would work with staff to actually manage the portfolio and the cash flows. We also challenge them on their pricing. So we have indicative pricing here. We want to know what they really want and what we can really get them to. So do a bit of the negotiation so that we bring back to you a solution that you can look at and beat up. I would also imagine having managers be here to present their capabilities and why they're good at this. I think this is a fair approach in this case because I know that you like to be involved in the manager selection process. Here, these are bond portfolios, and so they're really safe. So the delineations between these apples isn't as diverse as what we would see, say, in the private credit space or private equity managers or things like that.
And you guys have done this before. You've done this kind of a run before. And have you recommended these six before?
So one of the key ingredients here is going to be how well they interface with our staff.
That's right.
I have a couple questions. One, if we wanted, if staff wanted to do the cash management piece of this, could we then do two product managers, or would there be a solutions manager and a product manager, and staff would do it for a while and solutions manager could pick it up? Is there some type of a component to that? Because I know we're getting an investment position, and there's a lot of confidence that part of this can be managed in-house. And so I was wondering what kind of combination that could possibly look like. It makes sense to staff to have at least two managers because it's a lot of money. But possibly manage that, the liability piece of it in-house. So.
Yes. So a number of options are on the table. One, you could, to answer your question, have two product managers and staff could do the cash flow piece in-house. Two, you could go to any of the solutions managers and say, we like your bond portfolio. We want to treat you as a product. Keep in mind, this whole solutions products thing, this is our jargon. They'd be like, I don't know what you're talking about. But we could do that. We could work with them. So if we like any one of those pieces, we could piece them together in that way. So
okay.
Yeah, we really have a lot of flexibility on the table.
Okay.
Those will be great discussions to have, too, as you interview and spend time saying, how do you actually do this? What have you actually seen with other clients in the past?
So
another question is the use of synthetics or derivatives in any of these products, would we be looking at that for some of this stuff, or is that something we could mandate one way or the other, and would it matter in the mandate?
It may matter. It may not, though, because most of what they're buying is really short-term. So typically the use of synthetics comes in trying to do some duration management. These are generally highly liquid securities because we're talking a lot about treasuries, we're talking about short-term high-grade credit, so they're very liquid. So any synthetics that they would be using would also be very liquid. So they could be an effective tool. Most of the managers are going to tell you something like, if you allow us to do it, we will do it. It can probably help add some basis points during certain markets, but we don't need to. And so if you tell us not to, we're fine with that too.
Okay.
So.
What about leverage? What they're going to be doing? Will they be leveraging?
Essentially zero.
You indicated these six are basically, I mean, there's marginal differences, and that's about it, right? Is that?
Well, when we get into the portfolios, I think you're at the performance page. You're going to see some differences there, too, because of what they do and how they do it.
Well, my question is there a huge gap between these six and the six that you didn't pick? Or what stands out?
The six that we didn't pick. Yeah, you know, it was kind of a clear tier. The next six I'm not bringing to you for good reason. I don't think they would be recommended solutions here, that they would have either specific niche capabilities that we don't need. They didn't actually complete a compelling RFP, so while they did, they were invited to complete the RFP, what they sent back was not compelled. So I think what you have here are the six best.
You're saying it's a pretty clear cut.
Yes.
A pretty clear cut separation. Okay.
What about the size or the amount that they're managing? I know there's most of them the same, except you've got one that seems to be smaller. Isn't that?
1.5 trillion.
One is bigger.
Yeah.
One is bigger, one is smaller, and the others are up fairly close.
Are you looking at total firm assets or duration?
Yeah.
Firm assets.
So.
Firm assets, yeah.
Yeah.
So you got one that's big, right? And one that's relatively small, and the others are kind of.
So calling at $103 billion is still a pretty decent size manager.
Oh, I know. But this one has, it doesn't matter.
Oh. All of these are like large stable organizations, such that our strategy won't be disruptive to their operations. And while we would be important to them, we're not going to be the sole player there.
And we won't be ignored.
We won't be ignored.
So, Ed, the difference between a solutions manager and a products manager, if I understand it, the solutions manager can more
customize the timing of the selling and buying the investment so that you have the cash flow as you need it. Would it make more sense then to go with a solutions manager if we're going to use staff as well? Or does it make more sense to go with a products manager because we're using staff time to kind of manage the timing of when those investments need to be?
I think that's part of the discovery that we need to go through, and I think having staff have those conversations and figure out who's good at what, who wants to do what, will help answer that question.
All right.
I don't want to prejudge it.
Talk to me about the subsidiary of Taiwan. Is that really a concern?
I'm not sure where you're going with that.
Just from the standpoint of anybody who can do it, assuming we're going to have stable other investment duties, but in the event there is some economic chaos, there's a difference between having one in Newport Beach and go down and talk to them.
Oh, I see.
Versus
I see.
Somebody else whose headquarters are in Taiwan or something.
Yeah, so Conning's headquarters are in Connecticut. I guess that question would best be answered in terms of what is that ownership structure?
Yep.
Do they maintain full autonomy, or is there board seat representation? So we could
so you can look at that.
That. Yeah.
Any more questions?
Do you need anything else from us today?
We need a decision as to whether or not we're good with the six that Ed has recommended, and then staff and Veris will do additional due diligence and come back with finalists in December.
Mike, did you want to see all 12?
We go back and start over and do another RFP.
No, I just was curious about the process, that whether Rick et al. Had been a part of
that. I just wondered
if
that was
I just think that's another level of security.
I'm sorry, Mike, I couldn't hear you.
I think that just gives you another level of involvement and security. That's all.
But you just don't care to see all 12.
Madam Chair, before we leave this chart, did we have Ed discuss 16?
Yes.
So,
page 16 are the results. We have a page on each strategy as well, and that's important because they do approach this in different ways by taking on different exposures in corporates or treasuries, by going out longer duration or shorter duration, different credit quality exposures and what have you. When we take a look at this, we also provided some initial pages contemplating what if we put Insight and Prudential together. And the reason why we did that is Insight as a solutions manager, Prudential as what really has the highest return profile here. So isn't that an interesting combination? So when we take a look at page 16 then, this is kind of the genesis of it all, the Prudential short-term fixed income. Like I said, this has more credit exposure in it, less treasuries, and also slightly lower quality. So they've done a really remarkable job in managing the quality side of things. And you'll see that at the bottom part, over the past 10 years, they have not had a single year of negative returns, which is exactly what we want from this mandate. In fact, we only show one negative return here with Wellington in 2008. Everything else generating consistent performance or returns. And then the other component is that whatever we combine and create in today's environment, we generally would be expecting about a 2% return on this portion of the portfolio. It's a low rate environment, and so we'd love to be getting more, but the fact of the matter is that's where short-term credit bonds are. So when we look at this, it's hard to get higher than a 2%. And then in the appendix, when we start on page 22, there's a one-pager on each of these strategies. So for example, on page 22, portfolio characteristics at the bottom, we have sector allocations. You can see that Insight has about 25% to treasuries. And the other sectors there, you can see credit quality, 52% in AAA, nothing in BBB. And then the portfolio characteristics on the right-hand side, AA+, 1.2% yield, 1.25 years. So they are a shorter duration, lower yielding, but they're doing that cash management component versus, say, a PIMCO on page 26. You're seeing more across all of the sectors, more across the credit qualities, higher yield, longer duration. So each one of these, similar apples, but different. And their approaches and process and all that good stuff. Is that responsive, or did you have a specific question?
No, that was just like, we've talked about theory, but we're all looking at it in the past.
Yeah, gotcha.
Now, Rick and staff will be involved in reducing the six?
Yes.
And how many do you envision having the board interview?
You know, I would think two.
Two of each or two total?
The two.
The two.
Yeah. Because I think you have six here on paper that are all worthy of your consideration. Any of them can do the job. Any combination of them can do the job. So you're in a good position there. Short-term bonds, man. I wouldn't recommend this if we were doing private equity or private credit or something like that. But with this mandate, let's work together and figure out what that combination is to bring back the solution million. To you.
So do you want input from the board on who the two are? Why?
Because we'd like to see the board give that discretion to Ferris and staff, because the customization of the portfolio and the interaction that they have with staff to really make it work is
but
the key.
Isn't that our key mandate?
No. You can fully turn that over.
Well, I'm more comfortable with, I mean, I'm not discomfortable with what you've done. I'm not uncomfortable with it. And I know that's your job. But I don't think that's your job absent Rick knowing about it and being able to say, look, it looks good to me.
No, it's not absent Rick at all.
Yeah, it's
not
fully
at all.
Well,
Rick
he
just
said
hap-
it was up to
no,
the
no,
12.
No, no, no. Rick just is not sitting here today, but Rick is absolutely involved. He has been involved with Ed through this process from the beginning, and the plan is that staff is Rick and probably one other person, and Ed and whoever else he has on his team. So
Mike, I think Rick is more important in this decision making. I think Rick and Kathy are more important in this next step in the decision making than I am.
Exactly.
I think we've carried the ball to this part, but it needs to be handed off.
But my point is, he said earlier that the top, the 12, and then the cutting to six wasn't with staff.
No.
But I think what he was saying is he didn't feel that all 12 were
worthy.
Capable of
no, I get it. I get that. I'm not disputing that. I'm
but then the cutting from six to two, that'll be with staff.
With, absolutely.
Because my understanding is, on par, this is a relatively safe haven, so it's not real risky. And one of the key elements is how well staff is going to be able to work and coordinate with these folks.
Right.
And that's why it's important that staff have solid input.
That's right.
And when
that's
we ask Rick a question, I don't want him saying you delegated that to Veris.
No.
Right. I don't want that either.
So.
Staff will very much be involved in this.
Okay.
So I guess, Don, another way of thinking about it, because Michael was picking up on a theme there in terms of this strategy and the selection of these managers has very low investment risk because of what the portfolios are, a very low organizational risk because of the companies that you're looking at. And so these are the kinds of things that I would like board to opine on, because there can be pluses and minuses as we look at different asset classes and different strategies. And here it's not as much. The big risk here is how it interfaces with the staff. And that's why I think that the key next step there is having Rick and Kathy control.
Is there anything anyone else would like to contribute?
Just maybe just for Mike's edification, as we go down the road, the next people we begin to look at for our veteran will be thoroughly involved.
Correct.
Jeff?
I'm not clear what a motion that would accept what Ed is proposing would look like. But if I knew what it was, I'd be willing to make it.
It's on page four.
At the bottom.
At the very bottom, the bottom bullet. It starts with the recommendation that staff direct, that the board directs staff and Verisk to conduct on-site due diligence with selected investment managers, so meaning those six, determine liquidity portfolio structure and present a final recommendation to the board at the December meeting.
Okay. I'll move that.
And I'll second it.
Okay. Any other discussion? Then in that case, all in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? All right, then we are moving forward with that.
We'll put it.
I think
that
does have a closed session.
Is there a closed session?
Yes.
Okay. Then in that case, let's go and...
I'll make a motion that the board move into closed session.
Before we do that, maybe we should have members forum so that if anybody has anything...
Are you pursuing something besides this in closed forum?
Yes, but it's on the Buck Consultants matter, so no one needs to recuse themselves.
Just stay on. Okay.
That's fine.
Madam Chair, consider the motion all set.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? We are moving into closed session. We've moved back into open session at 3:11.
I have a readout from closed session for item 10C. Motion was made by Trustee Lynch and seconded by Trustee Dillon to accept the staff recommendation for service-connected disability retirement for Trujillo Jacqueline to be set for hearing. Motion carried unanimously.
Okay, that leaves us at members' forum.
I don't have anything.
I don't have anything.
I'm sorry I was late for a meeting for a long time.
I'll say.
I just wanted to recognize staff on the complaint log. I think that is a stellar complaint log report for me because you guys do a lot of business and I know you're shorthanded, and to be able to get by for 6 months with just a couple of complaints is amazing.
John, thank you. Gordon?
I agree with Jim. Meeting this morning took too long.
I got nothing.
What is the date of the November hearing meeting?
The 22nd.
22nd.
I'm in Dublin, Ireland on the 22nd.
I'm sorry.
It's going to be raining.
You could go all
in. It always rains in Dublin.
And I'll be in St. Croix.
It's going to be short days.
Yes,
we are.
You're worse than Hillary when it comes to overseas travel.
Okay. If Mike is, it's not a problem.
Mike, are you going to be here?
Yes. So when's the next
meeting? 22nd.
So there's only one in November and one in December.
Yes. Correct.
Yes. Only one a month now.
Thanksgiving week.
Yeah. We are. The Board of Supervisors is meeting that day, so we didn't see how we could say that we couldn't conduct a business when they were conducting business.
Don,
blame it on them.
No, thank you.
Kelly?
I have nothing. The whole world isn't retired.
Kathy?
I have nothing. Oh, other than...
Oh, yeah, tell you. Yeah, just come from...
Yeah.
There is an IGC meeting on November 15th as well.
IGC on November 15th?
I mean, it's all of that meeting.
Okay.
What's November
15th? IGC?
Internal Governance Committee meeting on November 15th.
Yes, you're right.
Just a reminder.
With that, we are closed.
Thank you.
Adjourned.
Sorry.